Thank you for those kind remarks, Dick. I appreciate the work you're doing here. When you hear the word apologist, you may wonder what that is. Let me define what an apologist is for you. An apologist is not someone who says he's sorry all the time. That's what husbands do. Listen to the ladies going, "Preach it, bro, I already like you." An apologist is someone who makes a case for what he or she believes. And I'm going to argue tonight, men and women, that when it comes to the issue of life, we are all apologists now. The days of believing that we can leave the defense of the unborn to a few paid professionals who get it done for us in our communities are gone. Our culture is sliding toward a devaluation of human life at a rate that is exponential. And tonight, I'm calling on you to join the forces of helping us. And to give us some sense of where we're at, I want to take you to the city of London, England, 2 years ago. By the way, I'm getting a little echo through these speakers. Is that because I'm coming up too close, maybe? Maybe I need to stand back here just a little. Is that better if I move back? Some people say no, some say yes. Relativism is true. There you go. Is that, you know what, we need to turn this one off. That's the problem. Yep. Is there a switch on there?
Yeah.
Ah, no worries.
Can you turn it down?
We could unplug it. Cover your ears.
Hank, where are you?
The sound man heard what I was talking about and split. Well, let me take you to London where I was about to take you. I had my youngest son, Michael, with me when he was 15. I was speaking in London, and I had a day free. And I'm a history buff. In fact, if I had a choice of where I was going to go 20 years ago, 25 years ago, before this pro-life thing interrupted my life, I would have been a history guy, a professor. And I took Michael with me to London because I wanted... We're still getting quite a bit of echo, aren't we? I'm not sure if it's the mic or if it's the... We just need to play with the adjustment, but I'll just keep talking for the moment. I took Michael to London with me, and we went to the Imperial War Museum when I had a day off. If you have not been to the Imperial War Museum and you go to London, let me encourage you to go. There is eye candy there you would not believe. There's a Spitfire hanging from the ceiling, the plane that saved the West in 1940. You know why we're not speaking German tonight? Because of the Spitfire and a guy with cigars named Winston Churchill. And I was explaining to Michael about this museum, and while we were waiting to get into the Imperial War Museum, I noticed outside the museum they had a series of photographs of the evacuees. How many of you have read the Narnia series? Why are the children in the country? Anybody know? Hitler had determined to bomb London and was targeting children. That was his whole intent. He wanted to rain terror on innocent civilians. Churchill said, "Get the kids out of here." And they put the children on trains at Waterloo, Charing Cross, and other stations. And you've seen the black and white photos where these children holding little numbers around their necks, some of them 2 years old, are standing on the platforms of these stations. Many of them will never see their parents again. And I was explaining that to Michael. And I felt this tap on my shoulder. And I turned, and here's a lady in her late 70s, and she points to one of the pictures and said, "I was one of those children." I grabbed Michael by the lapels and yanked him over and said, "We are going to listen to what this woman is about to tell us." She said, "When I was 4, my parents put me on the train at Waterloo in August of 1940, and I never saw them again." Go on. Well, not long after that, they were both killed in a vicious nighttime bombing raid. I said, "What happened to you?" She got a big smile on her face, and she said, "Oh, I had a good life. The family that took me in," listen to her words, "stepped up and adopted me." At that point, I'm bawling. And Michael's bawling because I got him by the neck. But notice her words, and I want to take you men and women to where Great Britain was in fall of 1940. Hitler had all of Europe. He was breathing down the neck of Britain. There were a lot of people in the British government that wanted to surrender, even in Churchill's own party. And that family could have looked at that little girl and said, "We're facing a threat externally so great, we can't take this on." You know what they did? They looked and saw a girl who had a need, and they did their duty. Men and women, we may not change Washington right away, but we have got to step up in our communities and be equipped to make a case for life, to defend the unborn. And tonight, I'm going to tell you how to do that. And I have some very good news for you. I understand that we look at Washington, we look at what's happening politically, we look at the fact that Planned Parenthood has been caught red-handed, doing awful stuff, and huge numbers of Americans don't care. We look at our churches, and we see pastors, some of whom will step up and do their duty, like the ones here tonight, and others who are so seeker-friendly they've become believer-worthless. And they're not stepping up and engaging the culture or equipping people to engage the culture. I didn't come here with the intent to preach, but something just came over me. But anyway, it's that Montana weather. When I left home, it was 28 degrees. I think I just came alive again. Preach it, he's bringing it. Okay. We have got to be the ones to step up, and I have some very good news for you tonight. You don't need a PhD in philosophy. You don't need a PhD in science. You don't even need a college degree to be an effective pro-life apologist. An apologist is someone who makes a case for what he or she believes. I want everybody to get ready to write something down, because I'm going to give you the pro-life case right now. Then we're going to talk about three questions that will help you clarify and defend it. Everybody get ready. We're going to write what's known as a syllogism. Who knows what a syllogism is? One guy. A syllogism is two premises followed by a conclusion. The pro-life argument has a syllogism. And you know why we're going to do that? It brings clarity to our thinking. Get ready. I want you to write P1 for premise one. P1, then a dash. P1. It is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise one, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. And you will want to write this down, because I'm going to quiz you on this repeatedly throughout our time together. You'll be saying this in your sleep tonight. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Premise one, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. You tell me, what's the conclusion? Therefore, abortion is wrong. You know what we just did, men and women? We just presented an argument. And you know what the beauty of that syllogism is? Every time someone brings up something that distracts from that, you're going to know it. You're going to say, syllogism, that has nothing to do with our argument. And you'll be able to steer the conversation back to where it needs to go. It is wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Therefore, it's wrong. And you're going to use three key questions to help focus public attention on that syllogism. And you know what the great news is? You don't have to be an expert to remember these three questions. These three questions will focus us back on that argument we just laid out. Here they are, and you'll use them in conversation. What is the unborn? Number one question. What is the unborn? Number two, what makes humans valuable? What makes humans valuable? And number three, what's the point? What is the unborn? What makes humans valuable? And what's the point? You master these three questions, you will be equipped to make a case for life on hostile turf. You will not be caught with nothing to say. So let's start with that first question. What is the unborn? The problem we face in America today is that the public has bought the lie that abortion is a complex issue. No, it's not. It's a very simple issue morally. In fact, what the public does is confuse psychological complexity with moral complexity. Here's the difference. If you knew a 14-year-old girl who was pregnant and her boyfriend was going to dump her, her parents wouldn't understand her, her church didn't understand her, she would lose the chance to go to college, she'd lose the chance to be gainfully employed, do you feel sorry for her? Of course you do. Do you feel sympathy? I hope so. But does it follow that because we feel sympathy for her, there's no right answer? Whether abortion is right or wrong begins with the question, what is the unborn? You have to answer the question, what is the unborn, before we answer the question, can we kill the unborn? And you know why that's problematic for us? Nobody out there is asking the question, what is the unborn? They're simply assuming the unborn aren't human, as I'll show you in a minute. My friend Greg Kokel has a great way of illustrating why this question is central to the debate. He says, imagine that you're in your kitchen sink one day, washing dishes after supper, and your five-year-old son or grandson comes up behind you with your back turned as you're at the sink there scrubbing away, and he says to you, Daddy, or Mommy, or maybe Grandpa or Grandma, can I kill this? What will be the first question out of your mouth? What has he got? Cockroach, snail, do whatever you want, don't show your mother. Neighbor kitty, whoa. And brother by the throat, you have issues, correct? By the way, any of you that don't think boys are capable of asking that question, may I enlighten you for a moment? I've been married for 30 years to the most glorious woman in all of Christendom. We have a son, 26, U.S. Army, son, 24, U.S. Army. We've got a son, 19, and a daughter, 15. I have personally heard that question, Daddy, can I kill this, more time than I can count? And almost always his hands are on his brother's throat when he's asking the question. Notice I was not invited to teach parenting skills. When you hear that little voice say, Daddy or Mommy, can I kill this? The first thing you got to know is, what has he got? You know what we just did with that illustration? Simplified the abortion debate. Can we kill the unborn? Yes. If what? If the unborn are not human. I do debates on college campuses, and recently my opponent has been Malcolm Potts. You don't know Dr. Potts, but he was actually quite influential in the abortion debate in England, because it was Dr. Malcolm Potts who got abortion liberalized in Great Britain in 1967. He was Planned Parenthood's first international medical director. He now teaches a population control class at that bastion of conservative thought known as UC Berkeley that I travel out to once a year to debate him in front of 660 of his own students. I love that, by the way. I have nothing to lose. My wife thinks I'm nuts, but I have nothing to lose. And in our last debate, Dr. Potts came unglued. I was supposed to speak first, and he preempted me. I was supposed to have 20 minutes to lay out my case. He'd have 20 minutes to lay out his, 10-minute rebuttals, a little bit of cross-examination, closing statements, and we'd be done. He preempted me. He went to the front of the class and said, our guest today wants to tell all of you women how you ought to be living your lives. And he wants to take his theological view and impose it on you whether you agree with him or not. And I find that appalling. He had 20 minutes. He took no more than two to rail on me and sit down. I was about to make a joke. You thought Donald Trump was bad, but I decided not to make the joke. But I got up to that mic and I did what I've done before. This guy did not do his research on me because what I did was nothing new. I said to that audience, men and women, I agree with everything Dr. Potts just said. He's right. We shouldn't impose on a woman's right to choose. He's right that pro-lifers like me should butt out of this issue. He's right that there should be no laws restricting abortion. He's right that I should not take my theology and try to make anybody else agree with it. I agree with him completely. He's right. If the two pro-life girls passed out at that point. If what? As some of you almost did. If the unborn are not human. And if Dr. Potts can demonstrate from the science of embryology that the unborn are not one of us, I concede. Because I told that audience, I'm vigorously pro-choice on women choosing their own health care providers, choosing their own worldviews, choosing the men they wish to marry, choosing the careers they wish to pursue, the cars they want to drive, the pets they want to own. I'm pro-choice on all those questions. But some choices are wrong, like intentionally killing an innocent human being simply because he's in the way of something we want. That's a choice a civil society should not allow. However, if Dr. Potts can demonstrate the unborn are not human, I concede. Do you think he took me up on my challenge? After I used the rest of my time to lay out my case, which I'll do here in a moment, in his rebuttal, here's what he said. After I laid out a scientific case for my view, which I'll do for you in a minute, his answer to that, he had 10 minutes, he took only about 2.5 again. He said this, Scott thinks he has all the answers. Well, he's the only one on the planet that thinks he knows when life begins because philosophers disagree with theologians, theologians disagree with scientists, scientists disagree with sociologists, and yet Scott's got all the answers on when life begins. Now, men and women, do you need a degree in rocket science to see the flaw in that argument? How does it follow that because people disagree, nobody's right? Did they once disagree on whether the earth was flat or round? Did it follow there was no right answer? Did they once disagree on whether women should have a right to vote? Yeah. Did it mean there wasn't a right way to think about that? The absence of consensus, says Hadley Arkus, does not mean an absence of truth. And Potts was basically saying that because there's disagreement, we can't know anything on when life begins. That's insane. By the way, if we don't know if the unborn are human, should we be killing them? If you're driving home tonight and you see what looks like an old man in the street, but it could just be an old black coat, are you going to run it over or err on the side of caution? Or to borrow an example from former President Ronald Reagan, if you're out hunting and you see bushes rustling in front of you and you don't know if it's that deer you've been after or your best buddy, are you going to open fire? Maybe if you're Dick Cheney, but no one else, right? You're going to err on this. That was bad. That's two bad jokes. Okay, we're going to move beyond. If you don't know if the unborn are human, you shouldn't be killing them. You've got to answer the question, what is the unborn, before you answer the question, can we kill the unborn? And you know why people don't answer that question, men and women? They simply assume the unborn aren't human. When Dr. Potts said we should trust women to make their own decisions, would he have ever argued that way if we were talking about killing two-year-olds? No, he wouldn't. Why does he do it with a fetus? Because he assumes the unborn are not one of us. He hasn't argued for it. He simply assumes it. And I want to give you a little tactic tonight that will help expose that assumption with the people you talk to. Because I'm going to tell you something. Most of the people you talk to at street level do not defend abortion rights in an intellectually honest way. Some do. They're not all dishonest. But a lot do, and I'm going to tell you something else. They don't mean to be dishonest. They just don't know better. And what they do, instead of arguing that the unborn are not one of us, they simply assume the unborn aren't one of us. Let me give you an example. What am I assuming about the unborn when I say this? Women have a right to privacy. I'm assuming the unborn aren't human, right? Because would I ever argue you should have the right to kill a 2-year-old in the privacy of your bedroom? The only way that argument flies with abortion is if you assume the unborn aren't human. You haven't argued for it, you just assumed it. C.S. Lewis said, the most dangerous ideas in our culture are those that are simply assumed rather than spelled out. Our job, men and women, is to take that assumption and drag it out into the open so we can deal with it. And here's the tactic you're going to use. It's going to be a little tactic called trot out the toddler. Every time, by the way, I noticed that some of you are taking notes faster than broke people at a Dave Ramsey seminar, and you're welcome to do that if you want to. But I am going to provide to Dick exhaustive notes on everything I'm saying here. And you will have, if some of you just want to listen, you're welcome to, because you are going to get notes like no notes you have ever gotten in your life. Now, you are still obligated to buy my books. Your salvation is riding on it. And I'm a Calvinist, so that sounds really weird. But you will get notes. What I want you to do is every time you hear somebody make an argument for why abortion ought to be allowed, I want you in your head to say, would this work as a good argument for killing a toddler? If the answer is no, what is your critic assuming about the unborn that they're not assuming about the toddler? That the unborn are not what? Human. So here's how it works. And by the way, you're going to be very pleasant when you do this. You're not going to be sarcastic. You're not going to be mean. You're going to be pleasant and engaging. Because by the way, as Christians, we not only need to have the truth, we need to be winsome ambassadors when we communicate it. So you're going to be winsome, but you're going to drag that assumption out into the open where it can be dealt with. So somebody comes to you and says, why don't you trust women to make their own personal decisions? Right away you're thinking, especially if you're a man, oh no, here comes that war on women vibe. I'm not ready for this. Don't panic. Don't get defensive. Don't say, oh, I love women. No. First words out of your mouth. I have a 2-year-old in front of me. And hold your hand out at waist high. First words out of your mouth. I have a 2-year-old in front of me. His parents want us to trust them to rough him up in the bedroom. Should we allow them to do it in the name of trusting them to make their own decisions? What will the answer be? No, you can't do that. Your reply, 2 words. Why not? Because he's a human being. Your reply, 1 word, said melodically, ah. Now, some of you can say that better than me. When I sing, things die, but you can maybe get it better. Ah, if the unborn are human like that toddler, should we be killing the unborn in the name of trusting people any more than we'd kill a toddler for that reason? Oh, but that's different. The unborn aren't human. The toddler is. Ah, that's the question we need to resolve. We've got to answer the question, what is the unborn, before we answer the question, can I kill the unborn? Are you with me so far? By the way, have I even argued for the pro-life view yet? No. I have simply framed the issue. Little debate trick here. He or she who frames the issue wins the exchange. Pretty much. Unless it's television, and then all bets are off. You are framing the issue around the question, what is the unborn? I haven't even argued for my view yet. Now, keep something in mind. Everybody, listen to this very carefully. We do not use trot out the toddler to argue the unborn are human like the toddler. That's not why we're using it. We're using it to show that's the question we need to resolve. Everybody clear on this? So let's try one together. You're out, you're in the supermarket, and you see your neighbor there, and you're there picking up some Pampers for your grandkids, and your neighbor comes over to you and says, so, Ever heard of population control? Don't you guys have enough kids in your family already? Right away you're thinking, how am I going to answer this guy? I don't like him anyway. And now he's come at me with how many kids and grandkids I have. And he says to you, what about all the scarce resources out there? What are you going to do about that if we have too many kids? You've heard this argument, right? Don't panic. Don't tell them there's plenty of land in Texas. It's true, but it's not the point. What's the first thing you're going to do? Let's see how well you're learning. First thing, I have a 2-year-old in front of me. Very good, some of you. I have a 2-year-old in front of me. There's not enough resources in the family to feed him. The family would like to eliminate their poverty problem by eliminating the toddler. Should they be allowed to do that? What will the answer be? No, you can't do that. Your reply? Not all. Some of you are too anxious. I could just see it. I mean, right here in this section, they were ready to wise like a choir. All right. First thing out of your mouth is, why not? Well, because he's a human being. Ah. Ah what? Not aha. Ah. Ah. If the unborn are human like that toddler, should we kill them because they're expensive any more than we'd kill a toddler? Well, that's different. The unborn aren't human. The toddler is. Ah, that's the question we need to resolve. Do you see how we keep bringing it back to the question, what is the unborn? You've got to bring it back to that repeatedly. Let's go back to our syllogism, just so we're clear on what we're trying to do here. What is our syllogism? Premise one, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Therefore, abortion is wrong. We have got to stay focused on the question, what is the unborn? Because that's how we deal with the syllogism. Let's try one more. Somebody comes to you and says, well, what about the fact that rich women can afford to get abortions if abortion is made illegal, but poor women won't be able to afford it if it's made illegal, and that will mean economic inequality. What was just assumed about the... I'm not laughing. This is Hillary Clinton's argument. What did she just assume about the unborn? That they're not human. Should parents have economic equality if they need cash to kill their teenagers? Some of you are going, wait a minute, now don't go, that one might have some plausibility. Dick didn't tell you I'd probably be the most offensive speaker you've had at this forum, right? I mean, the reality is nobody would argue that way unless they assume the unborn aren't human, right? You've got to keep dragging that out into the open. So let's trot out our toddler. I have a 2-year-old in front of me. His parents think they should have the right to kill this child, but the law says they can't, and now they're going to have to travel to a third world country to do it there. That's economic inequality. Do you think they ought to have the right then to go kill their child so they can have economic equality? What will the answer be? No, you can't do that. Your reply? Why not? Well, because he's a human being. Ah. Well, you guys are good. You've trained these guys well. Who spoke last time? Jay? Oh, Jay Warner Wallace? I'm sorry. No, good. One of my best friends. See how we just keep bringing it back to the question, what is the unborn? This is what we have to do, men and women. Well, I've raised the question. I'm going to answer it for you. What is the unborn? I'm not going to go to the Bible. It's the wrong place to go. The question, what is the unborn, is not a theological question. How we value the unborn is. But the question of what kind of thing the unborn is an empirical question. We're going to go to the science of embryology. And I'm going to give you what that science says in one sentence. And it's real easy. The science of embryology is simply this. From the earliest stages of development, you were a distinct, living, and whole human being. Everybody hold their hand up like this. Start pinching cells off the back of your hand. Go ahead, just pluck a couple of hundred somatic cells. Pinch yourself good. If your neighbor isn't doing it, grab something off the back of their neck. Get some cells, one way or the other. All right? Congratulations, you just sent a couple of hundred somatic cells hurling to their deaths on the lap in front of you. Every one of these cells that you plucked contains your entire DNA encoding. Did you just commit mass homicide? No. And you know why. These cells on the back of your hand are merely part of a larger human entity, you. They are not distinct, whole human beings the way you were when you were an embryo, the way I was when I was an embryo. There's a difference in kind between each of our bodily cells and the embryonic human beings we once were. Why is this difficult for people? Well, they will bring up some objections. I'll run through a few for you. They'll bring up twinning. How can you say that's a distinct, whole living human being at the 17-cell stage when that embryo can split into two up to 21 days after fertilization? Have you heard this one before? Yeah, you'll hear it. Question: how does it follow that because a living entity splits, that it wasn't a whole human being prior to the split? Or a whole living organism, for that matter. Anybody here ever cut a flatworm in half? Sir, what do you get when you cut a flatworm in half? Two flatworms. Does it follow there was no flatworm prior to the split? They'll bring up another thing. They'll say women don't grieve miscarriages the way they grieve the death of a newborn or a toddler. Now, I'm going to give you a little piece of advice here. We all know many women do, correct? But that's not what you should say at this point. Make that your second point, not your first one. Here's my question. How does my feeling about something change what it is? Suppose I got a text message tonight, when we take a break in a little while, that says one of my own children has just died. Am I going to feel worse about that than if I get an email saying 500 kids starved to death in India today? Is my own kid more human than those kids? No. I just have a stronger emotional bond, right? My feelings don't change what it is. You'll also hear people say, well, nature's the biggest abortionist on the planet. Why, there's up to a third to half of all conceptions spontaneously abort. Nature doesn't seem to be too worried about it. Why are you as pro-lifers? This is an example of what's known as the is-ought fallacy. How does it follow that because it is the case that nature spontaneously triggers a miscarriage, that A, the embryos in question are not human, or B, I may intentionally kill them? Do you see the disconnect with this? But people say it all the time. When President George W. Bush assembled his bioethics committee to deal with cloning and stem cell research, he did what President Obama didn't do. President Bush actually put dissenting voices on the committee. They weren't all pro-lifers. Robbie George was the head of it. He's pro-life. But there were others who weren't. And even some of these guys with degrees in philosophy and science brought up that argument I just gave you about nature triggering a miscarriage. And they couldn't see the flaw in it. Unreal. The question, what is the unborn, cannot be dismissed because nature spontaneously triggers abortion. But there's another reason why people don't get this. If we're honest, and I think it's helpful here to be honest, most of our intuitions don't look at that one cell or two cell embryo and say, yeah, that's one of us. I mean, can we all admit that naturally we don't just go there? So let me give you a little illustration that will help. Suppose we are in the pre-digital era and you have a Polaroid camera. How many of you will admit you know what a Polaroid camera is? For everyone under 55 in the room, let me tell you what it was. Polaroid made these cameras. The students, there actually was a time where we didn't have digital. We had to shoot pictures on film. And the way it worked for your parents and grandparents was they would shoot pictures. They'd be recorded on this round stuff called film. They would then drive the film, once it was all used up, to this little photo booth in the corner of the supermarket parking lot known as Photomat. They would drop off the film, wait 30 days, and half the pictures would come back overexposed. Right? Polaroid came along in the late 60s, early 70s, and developed this camera where you'd shoot a picture and it would spit out a piece of paper and you'd just wait about 90 seconds and your picture would emerge. Now, these pictures weren't the best quality and the focus wasn't all that great, but you got your picture right there. Pretend we're on a safari, a Mexican safari. You have, in the pre-digital era I just described, a Polaroid camera, and you shoot a picture of a black jaguar jumping across the trail in a Mexican jungle. Black jaguars are almost never photographed, but you got it. And while you're waiting for that picture to emerge, I come up to you, I rip the camera out of your hand, rip the paper out of it, and tear it up. Are you angry? Yeah, you're going to kill me, right? Even if you are pro-life, you are going to kill me. Now, suppose I said, what's the big deal? There's no jaguar in that picture. That was just a white piece of paper with a brown smudge on it. Are you satisfied with that explanation? You're going to look at me, and you're going to say, are you out of your mind? The jaguar in the picture was already there. We just couldn't see him yet. Men and women, from the very beginning, from the one cell stage, you were already there. We just couldn't see you. This is the narrative we've got to communicate to the culture out there. But there's another reason hindering people from grasping what's really at stake, and it's simply this. They don't want to get it. It's ignorance sustained by denial. And they've reduced moral truth, like we'll talk about tomorrow, to matters of preference. How do we reach those people and reawaken their moral intuitions? One of the ways that is most effective, and I've got 25 years of experience doing this, is to give people the option of seeing what's actually at stake in the abortion debate. How many of you saw the movie The Passion of the Christ? Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List. There's a common denominator to all those films, right? They're all really tough viewing, aren't they? Why did educators ship students out to theaters to go watch those films? Because those films convey truths that words alone could never convey. If you look at the history of social reform in the United States for the last 150 years since the Civil War, you will find powerful, provocative images used to change public perception about injustice. Martin Luther King displayed graphic, horrific pictures of African American men being lynched in downtown Chicago, and he so angered Mayor Daley that Mayor Daley said, if you don't take those pictures down, I'll arrest you, and King refused to back down. You see the same thing happening with abortion. When people see abortion, it changes their feeling about it as a predicate to changing how they think and ultimately behave about it. In just a moment, I'm going to roll for you a very short video clip. It's 55 seconds. I showed this at the debate with Malcolm Potts at UC Berkeley. My speaking team, I've got six speakers that work for me. They go into Catholic and Protestant high schools across the U.S. and Canada. We show this clip. We show it at Summit every session. We show it when we speak at conferences because it conveys the truth about abortion in a way words never could. But before we show it, I want to say a couple of things. Number one, parents, I don't think we have children here under the age of sixth grade, but if we do, I'll just give you my considered opinion. I don't think they should view this. You don't need to leave the room. Just ask them to not look at the screen during the 55 seconds. The rest of you, I want to tell you exactly what's in this film in case you don't want to watch it. You will not see an abortion performed, but you will see the aftermath, and I want to warn you, it's disturbing. It's tough viewing. And if you want to avoid the contents, we've taken the narration out of the clip so you don't even have to hear anything you don't want to hear. You can avoid this content completely by simply averting your gaze. Third thing I want to say, and please listen to me, There are people here tonight. For you to even be here at this session has taken unbelievable courage, because for you, abortion is personal. It's not abstract. And I don't know if I'm talking to a guy who encouraged a girl to abort or a woman who made that choice because you thought you had no other option. I want to tell you that I am not here tonight to beat you up. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm a believer in the gospel of Jesus. And that gospel, men and women, puts all of us in this room on equal footing before the bar of God's justice. The gospel says a holy God creates a good world, and we rebel against our Creator. We set ourselves up as God, and God, who has every right to snuff the entire race out, sends Jesus to bear in full his judgment against sin so that, get ready for this, rebels like me and rebels like you can be forgiven and reconciled to our Creator. Now you might think, well, why did God have to send Jesus? I mean, come on, can he just sweep sin under the rug? No, if he's a holy God, he has to punish it. And he did by pouring out his wrath on a substitute who bore it in full so you and I could be forgiven. But you know what else? The news gets better. Because for those who trust in Jesus alone for salvation, God the Father is no longer their judge. He's their dad, and he adopts them into his family as dearly loved children. It's possible there's someone here tonight, and tonight needs to be your adoption day, where we bring up a difficult topic, but for you, it's a pointer to the Savior who alone can relieve the guilt that all of us have to deal with. And so as we view this short clip, let's keep that gospel in mind, and then I'll say a couple of more things before we get ready for our break tonight. So again, if you wish not to look, feel free to look away. I don't know if we can darken the room a little bit, Dick, especially up here. I'm not sure. It's easy to look at something like this and think, is it really necessary that our side use this? And I completely sympathize with you, because I don't like these pictures either. But there's a historical example that I think will help us here. In 1955, an African-American boy by the name of Emmett Till, 14 years old, visited his cousin in the town of Money, Mississippi. And that 14-year-old boy got off the train in Money, Mississippi, began to brag to his cousin and his cousin's friends about his two white girlfriends back home. They looked at him and said, "You're nuts. We don't even speak to white girls down here. What do you mean you have two white girlfriends?" He said, "I do." And they dared him to talk to a white woman down there. That afternoon, Emmett, the cousin, and the cousin's friends, a group of about 10 African-American boys, went into Bryant's grocery store in downtown Money, Mississippi, a tiny little convenience store. Emmett purchased a piece of gum from a 21-year-old married woman behind the counter, a white married woman. He very innocently but flirtatiously flashed her a big smile and said, "Thanks, babe," and left. We don't think anything of that. Big deal in Money, Mississippi in 1955. Two nights later, that boy was taken at gunpoint from his uncle's home by the woman's husband and another man. They drove him outside Money, Mississippi, and after savagely beating him and working him over for several hours to the point where his body was nearly unrecognizable, they finished him off with a shot to the head and dumped his body in a river. The sheriff discovered the corpse, we think, 3 or 4 days later. We're not sure. He could not believe what he was looking at. Emmett's body was so badly mangled, his attackers had shoved a fan over his head, that he put what was left of Emmett in a box, not even a coffin, just a wooden box, nailed it shut with a note to Mamie Till, Emmett's mother, which said, "Don't open the box, you won't like what you see." And he shipped the body back to Chicago. When Mamie Till, Emmett's mother, got the body, the newspaper staff in Chicago gathered around her and said, "What are you going to do, Mrs. Till?" She said, "We're going to have a funeral for my son, and it's going to be an open casket funeral." The media went ballistic. "You can't do this. You'll upset people. You're going to anger people. They won't like you." She said, "I know it will upset people, but I want the whole world to see what they did to my boy." And that picture, which you can go Google, that black and white photo of Emmett Till in that coffin, let me warn you, it's a tough view. That picture was published nationally in Jet magazine, and it was a catalyst for launching the civil rights movement in this country. 3 months later, Rosa Parks was told to go to the back of the bus because she was black. What gave her the courage to stand her ground? She told us in her memoir, she said, I couldn't get the picture of the boy out of my head. What boy? Emmett Till. Why do we show pictures like this, men and women? Because I'm convinced that if pro-life Christians don't lovingly but truthfully open the casket on abortion, our nation's going to continue to tolerate an injustice it never has to look at. But here's the thing. As Christians, we don't just open the casket, we also open the truth of God's word with the good news that sinners can be reconciled to their Creator because Jesus paid in full. We offer truth, we offer hope. We're going to take a break at 8 o'clock, is that correct? Is that the plan? Okay, so I don't want to break the rules. What I will tell you is, when we come back after the short break, I'm going to give you a short philosophical defense for the pro-life view, and then we're going to look at 5 bad ways people are going to try to argue against your position. And the good news is, you don't have to memorize a million different comebacks. You just need to keep 5 categories of bad arguments in mind, and you'll be able to handle most of what you hear out there in the street. So that's what we'll be doing when we come
back. Before we go, stay right here.
Yep.